ABC Radio Australia.
And the offshore processing of asylum seekers is set to continue on Nauru after the government signed off on a memorandum of understanding with Australia to establish what's being described as an enduring regional processing capability. While the move has drawn criticism from human rights advocates, the funding that flows in for offshore processing from Canberra makes up more than half of the Nauru government's annual revenue. And joining me now to discuss the implications of this latest decision, I'm joined by the Director of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University, Professor Stephen Howes. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Jordan.
And alongside Stephen is Jana Favero, the Advocacy and Campaigns Director for the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. Good morning, Jana.
Good morning, Jordan.
And Jana, I just wanted to start with you. What's your reaction been to this announcement?
Oh, it's always devastating when we hear further commitments to offshore processing. We work with people who are in detention still on Nauru, those who have been transferred to Australia, and the human cost of our failed policies. I mean, 14 people have died in offshore processing, and we've got hundreds who are still suffering. About 108 people still do remain on Nauru. So it really is with a heavy heart, because we know that these announcements are made, they're shared on Twitter, people sort of blink and move on, but we know the real human cost of these announcements on people who are impacted by offshore processing.
And Stephen, coming to you, what was your initial reaction in hearing this?
I want to put it on the record. I'm not a supporter of offshore processing of asylum seekers coming to Australia, so I'm against it. But I guess I also want to look at it from the Nauru perspective. I mean, we know why the Australian government's doing this, but what's in it for Nauru? And I think it's fair to say that, you know, there is a lot in it for Nauru. Whether you support this agreement or not, you can see why Nauru, you can see how it's benefited from this agreement, and you can see how why it wants to keep it going. I mean, Nauru is, famous, I think, for its riches to rag story. It used to be one of the richest countries of the world with its massive phosphate resources back in the 70s and 80s. But it didn't save a lot of that money. It spent it all, and it went through a very tough period in the 90s and 2000s. And it's really this processing center that has turned that situation around. And I think there was a lot of, uncertainty as to whether that would continue. So I think this agreement, would definitely be a relief or something that the Nauru government would have wanted.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the economic perspective of this, and I think there are a lot of discussions around whether or not this policy from Australia and the memorandum that it signed with Nauru has been successful since it was sort of implemented back in around 2013. From an economic perspective, do you think that the policy has been successful for Nauru and the Australian government?
Well, I draw a sharp distinction between those two. If you start with the Australian government, I'd say from an economic perspective, it hasn't been successful. I mean, it's an incredibly expensive policy. And if you think about our broader objectives in the region, it really undermines our standing and our leverage. And, there's been stuff happening on Nauru around the rule of law that I think Australia hasn't spoken up on. And that's just because, we don't have the leverage. So it's a sort of compromising agreement for us, and we've seen the same in Papua New Guinea. But from the Nauruan point of view, from an economic point of view, it is a big benefit to Nauru. You mentioned that the revenue from the processing centre is more than half of government revenue, and the government really dominates the Nauru economy. I mean, it's a tiny economy. It's only about 10,000 people. And, it is very isolated, so it needs to be opportunistic. And this has come along as an opportunity for Nauru. And I think you have to give Nauru credit that it has negotiated hard. And so it not only benefits from sort of the employment around that contract, but it also extracts a large amount. Our estimate is last year, $150 million in various fees and taxes. So I think you have to give the Nauru government credit for being a good negotiator.
And Janet, coming to you, you mentioned that you or the ASRC view it as a failed policy and there's been a huge human cost to it. Can you expand a little bit more on that?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the MOU was originally signed in 2013, and since that time, over 1,000 people have been sent to Nauru, and so that's over 1,000 people who have been impacted by the policy because they are separated from family, they're not allowed to move on with their lives, they don't have settlement opportunities, while the original MOU did state that modest numbers may be able to be settled into Nauru life and community. We've heard that hasn't been possible for many people, and there have been scores of international human rights reports. There have been committees having a look at what has happened. There have been instances of horrific abuse against women. There were a reason that children had to leave. There was a whole campaign around Kids Off Nauru that was successful. Like, I could probably take up most of your show just listing all of the reason it is a failed policy. And I mean, I take the fact that it has contributed over about $4.5 billion to the Nauruan economy, but I'm firmly of the belief that there should be no business in abuse. And the Nauruan government could have said no to this cost and said no to it. Australia could have then perhaps given greater foreign aid or financial support to Nauru rather than it just being money for a policy that is devastating the lives of people. I mean, people who have sought protection, sought safety, who should be able to seek asylum in Australia, have their claims processed, yet 8 years later, many of them are still suffering because of that policy. So I do see it as a completely failed policy. I don't see any justification of the policy despite any economic benefits that may have flowed to Nauru. I do think that money could have been spent in foreign aid. And as long as you have countries and companies who are willing to accept money that results in harm and abuse, offshore processing will continue and detention will continue. And it has no longer become a sort of just stopgap policy. As the Nauruan president mentioned, this is a regional processing. It takes it to a new milestone. And it's something that, yes, was celebrated by Nauru, but was really lamented not only by human rights activists in Australia, but also by those who have been subject to offshore processing, whose lives have been significantly damaged as a consequence.
And coming to you, Stephen, if the processing centre, if this MOU had not gone ahead, the processing centre was shut down, because of that human cost and the calls from human rights groups, what would happen to Nauru's economy?
Yeah, that's right. I am more sympathetic to Nauru. I mean, there's no way that aid could have made up the gap. You know, as I mentioned, the Nauru government got $150 million from the processing centre in 1 year, plus all the employment. I think Australian aid to Nauru is about $40 million. So it's just a much smaller order of magnitude. And just to give an idea of the impact of the processing centre, I mentioned Nauru's riches to rags story that played out over the 80s, 90s and 2000s. But actually last year, the Nauru was readmitted by the World Bank into the high-income country club. So, you know, they've regained their high-income status on the back of this processing centre. The processing centre is not the only thing. Nauru's also done well by negotiating, be part of the group of Pacific countries that have negotiated a much better fishing agreement. So that's also been important. But the processing centre has been the key driver. And I think from Nauru's point of view, you know, they're thinking, well, if we don't agree to it, Australia's going to find another small island state that's willing to host this processing centre. So I think, you know, if we're against this kind of policy, and I am, we really need to sheet the blame home to Australia, not to Nauru.
And Jana, presumably being with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre and being in advocacy, you don't want to see processing centres offloaded to any other Pacific Island countries or small state countries. Do you think, though, with the Nauruan economy and the Nauruan people, that if the processing centre was taken away and that sort of policy was scrapped, that the Australian government does have a role to play in supporting Nauru's economy at all?
I think that there's a role for Australia to play with all of our neighbours, whether it's, you know, impacts of climate change or through foreign aid. So I think there's a role for Australia to be able to play as one of the richest countries in the region to be able to help those and help other neighbours. So absolutely, I sort of don't want to take anything away from a country that needs help. I mean, I work in advocacy for human rights, so of course I think that we should be supporting people in need. But what I do find really difficult to reconcile with is that there's just no excuse for abusive policies to thrive because there are places that do accept them. And I can understand from Nauru's point of view that they've taken this as an opportunity. But, you know, when the expert panel were looking in 2012 what could be alternatives to people and deaths at sea, which is what triggered this whole policy, there were so many other more humane alternatives that were put forward. And the only reason that offshore processing was accepted is because there are countries who are willing to take it. It's the same with saying detention facilities in Australia. We know that the private contractors make hundreds of millions and billions of dollars off it. But I do bring it back to the point that there should be no business in abuse, and no matter what economic boon it may be for individuals, companies or countries, I do think offshore processing and the known harm from it is unacceptable. And Australia could have an obligation as a good neighbour in the region to provide funding or aid in other ways, which is the pathways that we would prefer to see, rather than it being a paying off or giving money to more vulnerable countries in exchange for a harmful policy on individuals.
And you were saying just then, Jana, that back when those conversations were happening in 2012, there were alternatives that were put forward. Are there any concrete alternatives from the Asylum Seeker Resources Centre perspective that you'd be advocating for?
Yeah, we always know that to put forward a good argument, you need alternatives. In this case, there are so many other alternatives. I mean, we are the only country that has the level of failed policy that we currently do in terms of arbitrary indefinite detention. We've also done it before. I mean, if we have a look at post-Vietnam War, when we had, tens of thousands of people arriving by boat, we set up processes to process people's applications at the point of departure. We flew people over. We resettled over 250,000 people in the ensuing years there without having indefinite mandatory detention or having offshore processing. So community-based processing really is the best alternative. It is much more humane. People can live freely in the community and they can contribute while their claims are being processed. And it also, from an economic point of view, doesn't cost billions of dollars. Estimates are that it costs anything around sort of $10,000 to $90,000 per person per year, rather than nearly up to $600,000 per year. So community-based processing, which is done in many other countries, it was done in Australia, is the preferred alternative and the one that's put forward not only by ASRC, but also Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, UN itself, is the best alternative policy.
And Stephen, thinking economically about it, you were saying there that Australia's aid to Nauru only accounts for about $40 million. They have negotiated better sort of fishing policies. You're thinking about alternatives if it was taken away from Nauru. What else could be done from Nauru's perspective or Australia's perspective to support Nauru's economy?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think if you look back, you know, Nauru's always been a rather controversial country. And I think that goes back to the fact that it is so small and isolated. It has to follow unconventional policies. So in the late 1990s, when it was really, had spent too much of the phosphate reserve proceeds, it became an offshore tax haven. It started selling passports. Of course, that was very unpopular internationally. So it really floundered for a while. In the last decade, it's been saved by this processing centre. The fishing agreement has been good for it. Nauru, is looking to diversify. I think it realises that it can't take this processing centre for granted. I mean, the latest big and controversial idea is deep-sea mining. That's something that is, disapproved of by many around the world, including in Australia. But, of course, for Nauru, when you're a small island surrounded by a massive ocean, deep-sea mining is very attractive. So I think we'll see that play out. And perhaps see some of the similar sort of arguments. And I think Nauru is destined to stay in the limelight for pursuing these fairly controversial policies, whether you agree with them or not.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how the conversation continues. Of course, that memorandum of understanding has been signed. But thank you both for joining me to discuss this topic today. It will be very interesting to see how it continues to play out. Professor Stephen Howes from the ANU and the Asylum Seeker Resources Centre, Jana Favero, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan.